what happens in a lot of churches is we cheapen sin, so then grace becomes cheaper as well. And then it has a counterintuitive effect because we then lack grace and we're not able to be graceful. So we need to have a big sense of our own fallenness. And this is a Petersonian rule, by the way. It's assume the person you're talking to has something good to say, essentially, or knows something you don't. And you need to have that grace. You need to have grace with people.
Welcome to Chasing Leviathan, the podcast where we pursue big questions. With me today is my really good friend, Joe Donaldson. And today we're going to cover, with the rules for dialogue up for debate, how do we create common ground for action? So, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And really the two figures we'll be covering today are Jordan Peterson and Charles Taylor, two of Joe's favorite thinkers, men that I am vaguely familiar with. I'm a YouTube, you know, down the rabbit hole. I mean, most people have been down the YouTube rabbit hole, but so I have seen some Jordan Peterson clips, but have not spent a lot of time digging around other than some stuff that Joe has sent me. Charles Taylor, I read about 30 pages of a book about Charles Taylor on the recommendation of Joe. So,
which you said you were going to finish by today.
Yes, and then I lied. Instead, I went and had
broke
donuts
your promises.
With. Yes, I'm. Yeah, we can start there.
Yeah.
So Joe has been a teacher for how many years?
Five, six, almost. I'm technically just a substitute now, so I don't know if I count anymore.
And part of the reason he has moved on from teaching is to pursue a degree in seminary. His heart is to become a pastor and to shepherd and care for people's souls. And I think that's just a really good way to start thinking about today's question. But before we jump into all of that, Joe, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself? Give us that whole well-rounded story that gives us context for all your controversial opinions.
Well, it's not that well-rounded. In fact, one of my other friends literally says to me, "I don't know how the hell you happened because of the way I think." He has no idea how I ended up like I do. I'm from a marginally religious family. My mother was Catholic, and she became Catholic as an adult, so she was not raised that way. So she took our faith very seriously early on, and she became a Catholic when she became pregnant with me because she wanted to give us meaning. She wanted to give us something to live for and an overarching sense of goodness, right and wrong, those things, all American values. So that was me growing up. I was Catholic, and as a result, I still struggle with feeling guilty about every single thing I do. And feeling like I'm not good enough because that's the way I was raised. Then I became a Christ follower. I'm not going to say Christian because that term gets thrown around so many different ways. And that really happened because I started to make sense of Jesus and his work through reading C.S. Lewis especially. And then when that happened, I became what I would call a typical evangelical. For a while that was Baptist, which is just non-denominational for the most part. And then after that, I kind of languished in that world for several years. And I was part of a church that was making promises to me and not totally fulfilling them. And I'm very, very thankful for that. And I didn't really have the tools to deal with that kind of languishing, which I think is the case for a lot of men of our age. PJ, you had a good dad. Your dad's awesome. I don't know if my dad will ever listen to this, but he wasn't as there for me as I wish he was. He taught me how to play tennis, taught me how to do other things. So I didn't really know how to be a man, how to stand up for myself, how to have self-worth, and how to lead. And those tools you don't get from vanilla evangelical Christianity, as I like to call it. And it wasn't until 2017, which was probably the hardest year of my life, when all of that kind of came crashing down. I started approaching 30, and I was like, I haven't done anything. I'm nowhere closer to my goals. I'm nowhere closer to where I want to be with life. I am not married, and it wasn't working. And everything came crashing down with the end of a really bad relationship, the loss of what I thought was my dream job. PJ, you and I lost our job that same year.
It's where we met, too.
It's where we met, yeah, 5 years ago at TFA. And yeah, that happened. And then my friend Travis, who I hope PJ will have on someday, we started meeting and talking about this guy named Jordan Peterson, who has kind of become, he's called various things, the YouTube dad, all sorts of things. And he kind of became the person that helped me put flesh on a lot of my thought and, as you said, action, how to actually live uprightly. And he says really simple things, and people criticize him for that, but there are things that a lot of people don't hear. And I remember like 5 days after I had been crying on the ground because of a bad relationship ending, and I listened to a lecture from him on the flood. He did a series of biblical lectures, and I remember him talking about, you know, Noah, and this is not the best spiritual interpretation of the story, but the thing about Noah is that he paid attention. He paid attention to God, and he was prepared for the flood. And I realized I had not been living in a way that concorded with that. So I was not paying attention. I was not living in a way that concorded with what I believed was true. And when the flood came, everything just washed away. So as Jordan Peterson would say, sort yourself out, bucko. So I started to stand up for myself and my church. I started to get serious about developing skills, finding a career, and moving towards where I wanted to be, which you said was being a pastor. And yeah, so 2017 was the hardest year of my life, but 2018, I started dating. I didn't meet, but I started dating my wife. We got married that year, and I decided to leave our church that year for a new church. And so by 2019, I was in seminary and an intern at a different denomination. So that's kind of the story up to this point.
One of the things that I think could help fill in here is that your goal was to get opportunities to preach. And did you ever get to preach at the other church?
I never got to preach. I did a couple preaching labs, but I never got the chance to actually preach in church. I got a couple opportunities.
How many years were you there?
I was 6 years into a 4-year program.
Got it. Okay. And yeah, I think that helps provide. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was nowhere near closer to graduating. And, you know, Peterson, people think this is extreme, but Jordan Peterson likes to talk about organizations. They all become Babylon to an extent. And the way that they don't become that way is if people have the freedom to think and to speak their mind. And I just kind of put up with it, and that's what you were told to do. That's what you're told to do in most organizations. We've experienced that. That's what you're told to do, and you keep your head down, you keep your job. And I was told to do that, and eventually I might get a job. And eventually I just said, I'm done with that. I'm going to tell people what I think and ask questions that need to be asked. And when I didn't get the answers I wanted, it turns out they were, but because they were the answers that I needed in order to leave. They were also devastating because the mask came off of some people I really respected. So when that happened, it was time for me to go. And I took advantage of that. And I think the other thing that I forgot to really mention in this story was, while I really respected my pastor at the time, another pastor started meeting with me. I didn't even go to his church, and I got more time with him. Somebody really met with me and just listened and believed in me. And he is now my current pastor, and he really encouraged me to do some of those things too. So this wasn't just Peterson. This was also somebody personally taking an interest in my life.
Yeah. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no substitute for that personal touch.
Yeah. Yeah. Something you've always been good at is you're good at just sitting with people. I know you don't think you're a great listener, and yes, you can't sit still and you talk way too much, but you do really give space for people to be, And that's really important. So good on you, man.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to have you on here is what I really believe is your pursuit of truth, your pursuit of what matters in life. And I mean, really, that's what I want.
Which is this, not popular.
Well, that's what I really want this podcast to be about, is about what's meaningful and what's purposeful. And obviously, I come from a Christian, Judeo-Christian background. But what I like, I don't mind listening to people of other backgrounds. In fact, I want that. But I think there's just a real place and value that we can create in giving space to people. So thank you, Joe, for saying that. And it's part of the reason I wanted to have you on here is how honest you've always been with me. So glad to have you on here. Honestly, like, there's no one else I'd rather have across in the chair for me right now.
You said that, but I could probably come up with names. Some people you'd have to resurrect from the dead, but. You'd pick them.
But that doesn't, no. But then, like, there's that awkward.
Gadamer. You'd love Gadamer to be sitting here.
No, because then I'd have to, like, in 2 years, he'd have to come back from the dead. And then in 2 years after I got to know him, like, I'm already comfortable with you. And this is, like, the first episode. This is perfect. That's like, true. This is someone that I trust, someone that I respect. Like, it makes sense to me.
You watch Community, right?
I have watched a couple seasons.
Do you remember when Donald Glover met LeVar Burton and he just froze? He's just eyes wide open, stared, couldn't say a thing to him. That'd be you and Gadamer.
Yeah.
Be you and Gadamer.
Sure. Sure. Would that be with you and Jordan Peterson? At least your inspiration is live.
Yeah, probably. I'm actually writing a book right now, and PJ has read some of it, where I do plan to have my characters who are basically different versions of me meet Peterson, so maybe I'll filter through the three scenarios of what it'll be like to meet him. So, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know they were going to meet. Oh, because we're still in process. I didn't know they were going to meet him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the plan, and that'll be the...
Is he going to be on a mountaintop?
He will not be at a mountaintop, no. Okay,
I'm disappointed.
But he will be surrounded by tanks full of lobsters. That's kind of my plan. Those of you that don't get that, just Jordan Peterson lobsters on Google, and you will understand. You can even buy a shirt or a tie.
Oh, a tie. There you go.
When he appeared on Dr. Oz, he had a lobster tie on. That's true.
I believe it. So, quick question. You mentioned earlier in your story that really Lewis helped you to start making sense of your Christ-following faith, to use your turn of phrase. Is there any particular works by Lewis that really did that for you?
Yeah. For me, it was Mere Christianity. That really helped me understand the basics of the Christian faith, understand why Jesus died and what he came to do. And it was until then that I had this image of Jesus on the cross, because when you go into a Catholic church, I don't know if anybody's noticed this before, I'm sure some people have, but if you pay attention, Jesus is still on the cross and he's still suffering in most Catholic churches, and that's the crucifix. You go into a Protestant church, cross is usually empty if there is one. And I think that's a vast difference in piety, and it communicates a much different message. And so I was always confronted with the tortured Jesus. And I don't want you to get canceled on your first episode, PJ, but if you want more context for basically what my experience was, Louis C.K. did an episode on his show, Louis, called God. And in that episode, he's a little boy, and he's terrified by Jesus on the cross. He doesn't know what to do with it. And then this priest comes in and explains in like graphic detail everything Jesus went through. And so all he knows to do in response to that is to try to not be sinning anymore. And so he tries, and obviously he fails. And that's where I was too. I just didn't understand how what Jesus did helped me to be a better person, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense to me. One other thing you mentioned that I would want to, that I just wanted to ask about, you said that you were thankful, and maybe you misspoke. I just wanted to clarify, because it's a really interesting phrase. You were thankful for the broken promises of your former church.
Yeah. And I mean, I think eventually you start to realize as an adult that you go through hard things, but the hard things mold you and shape you in ways that the easier things often don't. And in fact, when hard things happen, oftentimes it's a door closing. So for example, what we went through a couple years ago at our former employee, if that hadn't happened, you might still be a teacher. We wouldn't be doing this and your company's doing amazing. So none of that would have happened if those things hadn't happened. So you just got to be appreciative of what the larger painting that God is making and what he's doing with your life. And that includes some really, really hard things.
It's really amazing how where you stop in the story really matters. So if you get laid off from a job or just, you know, don't have your contract renewed, you know, whatever phrase you want to use for that.
And I'm 0-2 in that area, 0-3 kind of.
But like when you look at those things, it's easy the month after to be like, oh, this sucks. But really, when you look at that, you know, years later, it can often be you're like, yeah, that wasn't a good fit for me. Or maybe, you know, one of the most important parts of mindset is to realize that what's beyond your control is something that you can't feel regret over. And so, I mean, and some of that too is dealing with the way you were brought up. You know, if you're like, well, if I had these opportunities, I could have done this. And it's like, well, you can control what opportunities you had.
Yeah.
Or even what gifts you have. You know, I mean, I'm 6'3" and I'm not going to play in the NBA. Like, I don't have all that, you know, it's just not going to happen. And, you know, it would have been nice to play in the NBA. I, you know what? That's not what I'm made for. That's not what I like to do. It's not what I want to do. Hmm. And so just, it's really about where you stop your story when it comes to these difficult moments. And you know, that's where you can, you know, we understand in a movie, because the movie, you know, a movie ends happily. In the middle of the movie, when things are at their darkest, or about 2/3 of the way, right, that it's going to get better, right? And we know that because we're outside the story. But when you're inside the story, like when you look at those, like when Tom Cruise has been knifed through the leg and he has to drop kick somebody in the middle of Mission Impossible, like that's a bad time. Like, we're enjoying that, but like if you're actually in the middle of a life and death fight in a bathroom, like that's a bad time, you know?
Yeah. 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 And I think story-wise, though, I agree with what you're saying, but sometimes it really doesn't get better and it takes a long time to get better. And even now, like just today, we've had some rough things happen. So that's what I really don't like about most Christian movies, is there's always this ridiculously amazing happy ending. And only one movie I've seen in recent years is where things go really bad and they stay pretty bad and they don't get all better.
And by that you mean one Christian movie you've seen recently?
Yeah, one right. Christian
obviously
movie.
There's a lot of movies that...
Yeah, I mean, we could potentially throw Silence into the mix of Christian movies there. It's Roman Catholic, but
yeah,
that's another one where... Yeah, that one's really hard. That's a different... That movie's not lighthearted at all.
Yeah, it's heavy. Yeah. But, I mean, coming from a Christian perspective... or Christ-following perspective, that's where the idea of the resurrection is so powerful. You look at Ezekiel 37 and just recognizing that, like, literally skeletons. Like, you know, yeah. It's not like you're, like, resurrecting the dead. You're resurrecting bones, and that's what God does. But and I think you kind of alluded to that. It's like I think that's a fair response to what I said, because it's when I say where you stop the story, sometimes you have to continue the story for years before it gets better. Yeah. And sometimes it's after death, at least from a Christian perspective. And, you know, that's a long time to wait for most people after death. So
yeah. And that's, you know, fair. One of our theological, I won't say idols, homeboys, whatever you want to call them, John Calvin, by all accounts, had a relatively unsuccessful ministry. It was full of a lot of suffering. He died way too young. But his story wasn't over. It went on even after his death. And it's expanded into a movement and probably one of the most influential voices in Christian history. So you never know what God's even going to do with you when you are in the ground.
Yeah. I mean, look at Van Gogh. I know that's a lot of people's favorite, like, Doctor Who episode. I don't think I've actually seen it. But, like, Van Gogh comes back from the dead to see what it like. He sold one painting in his lifetime, and he's one of the most celebrated painters of all time. It's not like he, I mean, depending on your view of mortality and what his state of faith would be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, he definitely didn't know that on his deathbed, right?
Yeah.
He didn't know. I mean, one of my favorite, and I, you know, I can't remember the exact quote, but Soren Kierkegaard, one of the things I've always appreciated about him was that he said, "No one gets me now," because at the time everyone kind of hated him. He's like, in 150 years, everyone will be quoting me. And I'm just like, yeah, there's an incredible amount of arrogance in there, which kind of makes me laugh. But there's also like an incredible amount of vision to see your life as part of a larger whole that continues past death.
Yeah. And with that too, there's this idea of fame. And fame is a really, a lot of people want, I mean, you're in the business of growing brands. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that because sometimes you do want to spread your influence. But if you look at a guy like Jordan Peterson, I mean, he blew up and he's probably North America's most famous intellectual. And he's helped a lot of people, so praise God for that. But at the same time, fame has been really brutal to him and his family. And now that he's going through some stuff and struggling with some stuff, you know, people are jumping on him like self-help man can't even help himself. And so it's brutal. Fame is a double-edged sword. You do get to expand your influence, but then you also get this scrutiny, and almost everybody has something under a rock that someone else can find and poke at. So it's very difficult, and it's almost better to just labor faithfully instead of reaching for the stars, so to speak.
Or they can make it up, which is also...
Or they can make it up.
Yeah, like, I mean, you can find stuff, and there often is stuff to find, but you can also, sometimes people just make stuff up.
Yeah.
Like they'll come in and attack you. If you get that target on your back, that stuff can happen.
Yeah.
Which I think is a great way to segue into our question for today. Again, with the rules for dialogue up for debate or kind of changing and evolving and splintering, how do we create common ground for action? And, you know, really that kind of comes out of, again, your reading in Jordan Peterson and Charles Taylor. But I think this is a really good example. We're in the middle of a pretty tumultuous political climate. We're trying to come to grips with, you know, the social dilemma just came out and people are still trying to grapple with all of that. And what even what you just said, that people get famous. And in a way that, I mean, you had paparazzi before, but when you talk about, you know, and it's funny, Marshall McLuhan, looking at TV, would be able to predict what was happening with social media, and it's just happened faster, and that's it. He was like, we're going to have people reporting just the smallest insignificant stuff as important. And so you had the 24-hour news cycle, and that was with TV. Now with social, like...
It's a five-second news
cycle. Oh, my goodness. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that. You maybe start with how did you find Peterson and how did you find Taylor and what attracted you to those men?
Yeah, so
to their work.
Peterson I found through my friend Travis. And he got famous through political action, which is really quite ironic because he was known as a clinical psychologist before then. He's a Jungian, and that can mean so many different things to so many different people. In fact, your podcast title is very Jungian, I think.
I mean, that's fair. Yeah.
It's fair. Yeah. So Peterson, I found that way. And what really drew me to him is what a lot of people deride him for is his plain-spoken nature, but his way of communicating really, really practical, deep truths on a ground level that allows for action, allows people to actually build a framework for his life or her life. And in that way, he's become kind of a dad to so many people, like I said. And, you know, he gets a lot of flack for being the alt-right intellectual, which he really isn't. And you actually watch him and you watch some of his more inspirational moments. He tells this story and he cries every time he tells it. He's walking around Los Angeles and this guy and his dad walk up to him. And this guy has his arm around his dad and says, "Dr. Peterson, I just want to thank you. My dad and I didn't talk for 20 years. and now we're united, and it's because of him. And so I think people need to be much more careful when they criticize a guy like Peterson to not really think through how much good he's done. And I don't think he's done nearly enough evil to counter that. So for me, that definitely helped. PJ and I have talked a lot about it. I'm still not good at it. Something as simple as stand up with your shoulders back, and that gets into weird lobster stuff and whatever. But you actually really start thinking all right, about...
Tell us a little bit about the lobster stuff, because I don't know that I completely understand it, and not everyone listening to this will. And as it stands, the weird lobster stuff, it's definitely a moment of intrigue here.
Yeah, so the he came out with 12 rules for life, and one of the rules is to stand up straight with your shoulders back. And that rule, he talks then about lobsters will get in dominance hierarchy fights, right? And if a lobster loses, it hunches. And when it hunches, its brain chemistry changes in a similar way that it would with a human when they get depression. So Peterson used this. He's an evolutionary psychologist, not an Orthodox Christian by any stretch of the imagination. But he used this as an example to say if our posture could change our brain chemistry. So if we walk around with our shoulders back, like confident and like we're going to take on challenges, that affects our brains, that affects our outlook, and it makes us more positive people. So that's the lobster thing, and it's very obscure. It something, again, that people like to make fun of him for, but he has a point, and it leads to some interesting branding opportunities. I got Travis for Christmas last year a top lobster tank top that he wears when he works out. So that's fun.
Seems appropriate, yeah.
And then Taylor is interesting. He is... For those who circle in the camps that you and I do, he's kind of become the – I don't know what right term it would be, but it's become the way that most Reformed evangelicals think about culture and the way people think. And he primarily does this through a very, very large intellectual history called A Secular Age, in which he traces out how we kind of got here from a pre-medieval, pre-modern outlook. And that book is popular, I believe, because it's given pastors, theologians, those people who interact with the world at large, a framework for understanding how people are thinking. And so Tim Keller has a list called his Master Cultural Reading List, I think, and he... A Secular Age is on there, After Virtue is on there, Triumph of the Therapeutics on there. But I kind of found Taylor that way because everybody was writing a book on him, talking about him. And I was just tired of reading things about him. And I was like, I need to read him. And once you do, it really is like, you know, with Wittgenstein, you feel like you're talked out of the bottle and you kind of get out of it and you see all the flies still stuck in the bottle and you're like, guys. And yeah, it gives you a perspective on how we got here as a culture that's very illuminating, and I've really, really come to appreciate that.
And there's a lot of works and a lot of ways, I think, to get outside of our cultural box, or, you know, they talk about the fish that doesn't realize it's in water, to get to realize that we're in water when it comes to our culture.
It was a frog.
That also works. Well, actually, that one's a little confusing because frogs can also breathe air. That'd be like
that's a good point.
That'd be like missionary kids who come back from another culture and then they don't feel like they fit in either one. They're like culturally amphibious.
Yeah.
But just to clarify what you were referencing there, one of my favorite definitions of philosophy is by Ludwig Wittgenstein, and he said philosophy is helping the fly get out of the bottle. Which seems a little obscure when you say it like that, but I think we've all experienced being in the car with a yellow jacket, with a bee, and trying to get it out of the car, and it keeps hitting the windshield instead because it can't figure out the glasses there. And so his idea is that we are stuck thinking we are seeing the exit when actually the exit is just in a different direction. And so thinking that something is clear, but the clearness is actually part of the problem. Obviously, I love that. So, yeah, thank you for bringing it up. Awesome. So, how has from Taylor's perspective, and I think this does come more from Taylor, how have the rules for dialogue and conversation changed and been broken down?
Well, essentially, the Christian faith is a pre-modern idea. It's 2,000 years old, and it's built a lot of the theology and, as you and I have often talked about, it's built off of classical metaphysics, which you and I think have some differences on. But if you even think about how Christianity developed into the Middle Ages, it has a framework for belief. It has a way of looking at the world. I'm not going to say worldview because I'm not 100% sure how I feel about that word. And essentially what it means is until we talk about how people think and how they view the world, until we talk about how society at large thinks, which Taylor calls a social imaginary, until we actually think about that, you can convert somebody to the faith, which is what everyone's obsessed with. We can do evangelism and produce somebody who's not really living like a Christian because they're continuing to live in a modern worldview where their faith is just one part of their identity instead of the thing at their core that informs everything they do. So you'll see this a lot with kids, especially the way that kids will prioritize soccer over youth group because they're a Christian, but they're also soccer player, or they're also an artist. And I think people really, really struggle with this. And I think when you start thinking about it that way, then you realize before we even get to the faith question, what facts do you believe in? You have to talk about Christianity as a lifestyle, as something that impacts every part of you. And Taylor's written a lot too on identity and how people used to not really think about who they were or what they did. They just did things. You don't really think about what my job says about me as long as it puts food on the table is a good example. So that's some of the areas I think that he's really helped. And he's also, I think one of the other things that helps is people can take a step back and not be so hard on people because people really are products of their culture. And if you grow up like me in a mostly public school or a nominal Catholic background, you basically grew up like everyone else. You know, it takes a very, very deep catechesis, reading of specific books to end up a certain way, which is, again, why my friend says, I don't know how the hell you ended up the way you are.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think that, you mentioned the importance of a job that puts food on the table. And, you know, it's even come up in our own stories that we've shared.
True that.
Do you think that part of the reason that we emphasize security and employment is because of the lack of security in our culture?
That's a good question. I think so. But I also think a lot of it, to circle back to what we talked about with Peterson, I don't think people have good ways to actually think about who they are and put into practice things to have a good career or to get a wife, to be a good dad. I don't think people actually think about that because all they're given is platitudes, principles, and they're not really given a true framework for how to do those things.
Would you say that is maybe a bridge between Taylor and Peterson's work, that Taylor is talking about how that fragmentation has happened, and Peterson is largely dealing with how we deal with that fragmentation rather than exploring or does Peterson get into that as well? That fragmentation of the self, which, by the way, I believe the book you were referencing with Taylor is Sources of the Self.
Sources of the Self.
I may know what it is because I may have bought it. So
yeah, that's my next one. I'm still trying to get through A Secular Age, but that's next on the list for me.
Yeah, good luck. It's bigger than the other one.
It's bigger than the other one. That's great. That's wonderful. Yeah, I actually think there's a lot of corollary there. So Peterson, he's well known for 12 Rules for Life, but his book before that was called Maps of Meaning, and that was his first published book, I think, in 99. And that is – I haven't read that, and nor do I think I ever will. But he was concerned with how people make meaning, and particularly concerned with myths and stories. And I think there's overlap there because Taylor would look at the myths and stories and say that they're emblematic of how the culture perceives reality. And he does a lot in showing different art, even different music in the secular age, and how it conveys certain ways of looking at and thinking about the world. So I think there definitely is some overlap there. I think if you think about it in terms of a map, Taylor definitely lays out a map. And then I think Christianity provides the route. And then for me, in a lot of ways, Peterson has been the model of the car I go with, I guess. I don't want to stretch that too far, but he's definitely not the engine, but he's given me a way to think about how I get there in the day-to-day existence as a sojourner and a pilgrim upon this earth, trying to make sense of my existence, which is continually perplexing.
Life is confusing. Really interesting. So in terms of how – so we know that it's fragmented. And do you mind just exploring a little bit more how that fragmentation happened? So like it is pre-modern. How did that split happen?
Yeah, I would say that split primarily happened when
– or rather, I should say fragmentation, because I feel like there's more than – it's not just like two things, right? Yeah. It's like yeah. Sorry, excuse my –
yeah, God was really – I think it started when God was pushed out of our normal day-to-day experience. And I think once that happens, people – the rest of the identities kind of falter. So you cease to then – when that first domino falls, so to speak, as God is pushed off of the public sphere, as you think about 18th century deism, for example, which is a result itself of a lot of other things – once that happens is I'm no longer a Christian, and then the great American experiment happens, and it wouldn't be possible without that deistic perspective, which a lot of, you know, gun-toting all-American people don't like to admit. But in some ways, the American experiment does some damage to the idea because it's built on a framework of individual identity, you expressing yourself, saying to the king, I'm not British, I'm an American, and then you kind of get to choose your own identity, which then leads to the gradual erosion of such things. And 250 years later, every part of your identity is now up for choosing. But it's all started with pushing God out of the sphere and like he's not interested or involved in your life, whereas before you needed him. You know, you were a specific religion because, you know, your king was a Lutheran, so you were a Lutheran. Because you didn't really have a choice and you needed God because the world's scary.
Well, and it's interesting, even from the little bit I've read of Taylor, it's not even that you need him. It's just that he was part of the water. Like everyone just accepted him. Like it wasn't even up for it. Like people would talk about like not believing in God and people are like, good one. You know,
they didn't even conceive of it as possible.
Yeah.
Because they had no way of making sense of the world without God. Even if – I mean, we're not saying, you know, everyone in the Middle Ages was saint-like because they weren't. But they all had a theistic outlook in some way. Even if some of them were complete and total monsters, they still believed in a God and they justified their actions with that God usually.
And it's I think what you've brought up here is important with the reference to deism. That we often want to make this jump directly to atheism from theism, and that was not the case.
No, it's not the case. And one of the things, my favorite aspects of Taylor's work is he shows how a lot of the debates that we're caught up in. So if you think about creation debates, so think about Ken Ham. Again, I don't want to get you canceled, but I don't know if there are any Ken Ham fans that are really going to dial in. But Ken Ham is obsessed with –
I don't think there are enough fans to cancel me. But go ahead.
Yeah, Ken Ham's obsessed with proving God as creator. And he thinks that's the apologetic to get people to become Christians. It's like that's like the last place you want to start, you know? Hmm. You want to start with Christ. You want to start with his resurrection because that's really where our faith has meaning. And we're only arguing that way because, again, we moved into that deistic framework – where that was the apologetic was look at this universe, look how God ordered it. And instead we're not looking at the larger questions of real life, of identity and those things.
So I think that kind of brings us to how do we find common ground for action? We've talked a little about the splintering side of it, but how do we find this common ground for action? There seems to be, you know, what does that look like from a Christian perspective? How do we, how do we bring people into the fold? You kind of mentioned that. But, I mean, when we talk about these sorts of things, we also have to consider living our day-to-day lives. And in the public sphere, how do we handle how do we handle common ground? So feel free to address, you know, either of those questions first. But, like, how do, as Christians, how do we bring someone back in to the common ground of Christianity? And how's that common ground changed? And then how do we find common ground with people so that we can pursue action that aren't Christians?
Yeah, and I think one of Taylor's biggest proponents, as I mentioned, is Tim Keller. And I think as Christians especially, we need to approach people outside our faith differently because their lostness, for lack of a better word, is so much deeper than just intellectual assent to a certain ideals. And I think once you realize that, and I don't know if this is exactly correct, this might make me a heretic, but I think a lot of ways someone who thinks more like a pre-modern person, who thinks more grounded in terms of your values and ideals, is probably more in common. I mean, I would say I had more common with a person like that than someone who, you know, your typical Republican, all-American Christian. That person's worldview is, and way of looking at the world and way of conceiving their identity is probably more different, even though they would claim to be a Christian and you would claim to be a Christian. It's probably more different than a lot of your friends that you may know from, you know, I'm sure people you work with, I mean, you work with mostly family. I'm trying to think of an example, but
you're a bad example, PJ. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm just trying to say that, like, I think we have more in common with people who care about kingdom priorities, because I think thinking about the kingdom of God as an overarching concept, and that's really what you try to do with your work and the way that we conceive of it at Candid Go, is we are spreading God's kingdom. And we're not saying that we can partner with somebody who agrees with us on some of those things. So spreading some kind of justice, which is a buzzword, but Christians should be about justice. And we can talk about that. We can talk, have conversations about racial justice and not be like, you're a social justice warrior and I'm going to write you off. But you can have that conversation, and you can probably have it better with, again, let's say you go to a coffee shop and you meet with a client who's in a similar line of work as you, is your similar age. I'm sure you've had this experience before, and you're like, I have more in common with you than, you know, your wife's parents. Even though they would probably both claim to be Christians, you're like, I have more in common with you. You care about the same things that I care about. And I think finding those common values is a good place to start. And then I think where the faith comes into action, this is what Keller does so well, is you find people with those values and you go, okay, you care about justice. Well, what is justice? What are the standards for justice? And once you ask those questions, you get them to think, I have no standard outside of God's existence or out of some moral authority. Now, like Taylor is so good at pointing, the problem when you do that is, of course, then people go, oh, I need that, but then they just forget about it, or they write it off, or they don't let it actually go to their foundations. So I think finding people with common values, common goals, people who are unintentionally building the kingdom of God in their work, doing good work, those things are all ways that we can build common ground, I think.
Got it. Yeah, I think I understand your point that while I very much get along with my in-laws, both my parents-in-laws and my brother and sister-in-laws, like, there is a certain kind of ease that comes with talking with someone who's not a Christian, who doesn't, where politics is just something separate. Whereas sometimes when you talk to Christians who infuse their political views together, you can often run into awkward situations where it now becomes something about the Bible in ways that maybe don't actually fit.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, slam my in-laws either. I was actually very happy with, like, and I've always been surprised. And I think this is one of the encouraging things, is that just when you think like people can't change or like they, you can't have conversations. It's always surprising how even in vanilla evangelicalism, you can find people who like, I mean, you yourself, you start out as vanilla evangelical. But the Holy Spirit can work and find ways, for people to move beyond that and to actually pursue truth.
Yeah. And I think it starts with, like you're saying, with conversation, with dialogue. Not to get political, but we really do need to talk. We need, you know, Peterson is a big fan of telling the truth because he doesn't mean this like live your truth sort of thing. But if you say what you think and it's,
and how you feel
and how you feel and it's dumb. And if you're with people who are going to be honest with you, who again, don't even really have to be Christians. They can be people who tell you the truth and who care about you. That's possible for people who don't know Jesus. Yes.
Yeah.
Shocking, I know. If you tell the truth to people and you're wrong, they'll tell you you're wrong, hopefully. And or they'll share their opinion and then you'll have to think about their opinion. And I think that's the only way that people build common ground, and that's what's happening in our world is we're not willing to talk to each other.
And so there are two ways that you can not talk to each other. One is that you can just refuse to say what you think, or is you can just refuse to talk to the other person.
Yeah.
Which is all, I think, more of what we're running into
or
now.
Or shut them down, too.
That's where, I mean, you mentioned, like, I can't imagine, like, I talk to some people about, like, their in-laws. Like, my in-laws, I can tell them, like I can tell them what I think, and I have. And they've told me what they think, and that's been okay. But yeah. that's a rare gift.
So to share an example, and I don't think this person will ever listen to this, and maybe I should have said something to them, but we've been in the same church with them at one point. I'm not going to say when. They're Christians, and I think the husband's a really, really good guy, but I'm not even sure I can say this word. You might have to edit it. But she started using the word fag flippantly to describe someone in Hollywood. And I was like shocked, you know?
Yeah.
And I just think,
I should be.
You can't say that word anymore. And it's not right to say it. It's a very, very derogatory term, regardless of how you feel about the homosexual community and their status. They're people.
They're still, yeah, they still, like, yeah. From a Christian perspective, bear the image of God. So to just like,
Continue your story.
That's not okay.
And
that's
an area where it's like I supposedly share the same belief system as this person, but their way of looking at the world is very different than the way that I look at the world. And I think maybe a good example is Peterson himself, because he's not necessarily an Orthodox Christian, but he shares a lot of the values of what flourishing is, of what the good life is. That I can partner with somebody like that in a lot of ways. If I ever had the chance to work with him about getting people to just be better versions of themselves. And I think you experience this a lot in your business where you're partnering with speakers and other people who, you know, maybe not the most Orthodox Christians, but they're trying to bring order to the world. They're trying to help people maximize their potential. And
most of them are not Christians. Yeah. And that's, yeah. And that's just okay. They're good people. I enjoy working with them.
Yeah. And maximizing profits for a business is a good thing, because the more profits companies have, hopefully, the more people they can employ, the more this, the more that. So,
well,
all of those lead to flourishing in some ways. I know.
I would say like your goal, I think the problem gets, your goal can't be to maximize profits. Like that can't be your complete end goal. So you have to find some other end goal that lends itself to maximizing profits. But if you just say,
that's true.
I don't want people to like, I should like have all, yeah, buy
a, you, making a better product.
I know you believe that, like, what, yeah, yeah. Whatever, like, it's not like you're just like get rich or die trying, you know, that's not you. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Just didn't want to leave that hanging out there. That's good. But that, I understand what you're saying too, though, that like, by making good products, by making profit, like profit isn't in itself bad either. It's kind of a secondary thing. Like money is not an end in itself. It's something that helps you do other things. So agreed. if all you think about is making money, that's not going to end well for anybody.
Right.
But like you said, like, I mean, making money, as people who together lost our jobs, you know, we lost our jobs together, like, money can be helpful, like, especially with like a wife and kids. Like, I mean, that's just like, especially as a upcoming father, I know that you feel that pressure.
Yes.
Very much.
Thank you for telling me to quit my job and come work with you, PJ. I'm not nervous about this at all.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's the little things that, that I like to bring. Oh my gosh.
And I'm just going to say, like, speaking of, I mean, there's this thing called the internet, intellectual dark web. And I don't want to keep going, but there are people who believe in things like free speech and they get labeled as alt-right. But if you look at the people who are part of it, there are people who share common values, but their belief systems are wildly different. Joe Rogan's into psychedelics, and that's basically his religion, for lack of a better word. Sam Harris is a staunch atheist. Ben Shapiro is a Jewish person. It's like, these are like three of the leading figures, but, you know, they believe completely different things about how the universe was made and the existence of beings outside of those we can perceive, and
even their actions, like they're, like from the big to the small, like like on small particular issues. Yeah,
but they find common ground because they're about creating a liberal society, not in the socially left concerning way, but a free society where people have free speech, because that leads to dialogue, which leads to us coming together in this project of words to create meaning in this world.
Which that's I believe the term is classically liberal, you know, that's one thing I've always appreciated reading The Economist, the idea that free trade, the free trade of ideas and products is a good thing, you know, which so free trade of products, ideas, and free speech, you know, like all these things are just like are worthwhile things. And, you know, obviously these things even now are kind of up for debate. But I think, you know, even in America, people would not be willing to discard really any of those things. They would just want to redefine them. Not, you know what I mean? Like, no one's going to just be like, no, you can't have any free speech. And they might just be frustrated in specific cases. And that's, you know, that's a whole nother discussion about censorship, which I've always found personally fascinating. But, let me ask you this. As we wind down here, you are studying to be a pastor.
Yes.
As a pastor, what is the biggest thing you can do to either solve or just navigate well this splintered situation to create common ground, both within your congregation and within your community as the leader of a church?
Yeah, and this is going to be counterintuitive, I think. But I think people's understanding of sin needs to increase. And I don't mean that you need to make people feel guilty. You just need to make them feel the weight of how we have sinned against God. Now, this is good news, right? Because I think what happens in a lot of churches is we cheapen sin, so then grace becomes cheaper as well. And then it has a counterintuitive effect, because we then lack grace and we're not able to be graceful. So we need to have a big sense of our own fallenness. And this is a Petersonian rule, by the way. It's assume the person you're talking to has something good to say, essentially, or knows something you don't. And you need to have that grace. You need to have grace with people. So I think the big thing I want to do with people, if I'm ever given a call to the pastorate, is for people to apply the gospel in that sense, which is the good news of what Jesus has done, which necessarily entails you having an understanding of your sin. And then once that gospel is preached in every week, you're having to repent. Practically speaking, what that does is it teaches you to be thinking, I could be wrong in some areas. Hmm. It teaches you to be cautious of pride. It teaches you to evaluate your perspectives. And I think it's a shame, you know, that people don't understand this. But if you think about a lot of the churches, particularly in the South, the Bible Belt, I have no political leanings that I'm going to speak of, but, you know, the people in the churches that voted for Trump, bleed red, white, and blue, own guns. A lot of those people lack grace because they don't have an understanding that Jesus is the one who saved them. And that's Taylor, too, talking about how belief developed in America, where it became more about pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so, and then people on the left, more of the left, don't understand grace because they don't understand sin. So they don't understand sin either. And then both sides end up screaming at each other. It should be biblical Orthodox Christians, or at the least epistemologically humble people who have the grace to say, hey, you might know something I don't know. And let's talk. And then once we talk, let's find a plan moving forward for how we can address the situation, work together, partner for racial justice, partner together for correct policing. Any of the issues really, really starts with that humility. And I think better than anything else, the gospel gives people that humility because it teaches them who God is. Once you see who God is, then like Kelvin said, then you can know yourself. And once you know yourself and you come to know God more, that gap widens. That gap widens, and then you become more humble, hopefully, which is the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I'm going to find a way to work him in, but Gadamer talked about how humility is the grounds for conversation. And I think what you're pointing out is that an understanding of our own brokenness, and from a Christian perspective, that's brokenness from even a secular perspective, and maybe this is where we find common ground, it's human fragility, human finitude.
Remember, thou art mortal, right?
Right, right. All these things that we can definitely look at and say, this is something that we need to dwell more on as the grounds for humility, which will then provide the correct grounds for conversation.
And this is something I've heard talked about from a lot of people have said that a lot of the more radical left functions like a cult because they know 100% they're right. And they know that they have the correct answers and everyone else is wrong. That's not a good starting spot. I mean, right and left does this. That's not a good place to be because then what if you're wrong?
Well, and I think that's where, you know, we mentioned in passing social media, but people who are very, very sure of themselves do better on social media, which also means that people who are far right and far left and are very assured that they have the right answers, even to the point where they are unwilling to listen, do better on social media. And so then that's part of the divide that we're struggling with.
Yeah. And the algorithms are not made to give you something that you disagree with, because if you see something you disagree with, most people disengage. And so it doesn't want to give you a different perspective because then you log off, and that's not what it's designed to do.
And that's the difference, right? Like we mentioned this before, there are two ways that you can not tell people the truth, right? You can just lie to their faces, or you can just not talk to them at all. And so when you're in person, it's kind of hard to just like not talk to somebody. But when you're on social media, you just click off. And so what we've been able to do is just disengage, just like you said.
Yeah. And I think the other piece of this, I think, is valuing people.
Hmm.
And the Christian worldview does give you that value because you say to people, you are made in the image of God. As C.S. Lewis said, you have never met a purely mortal being. Everyone you have met is immortal. And if you saw them in their true state, they would utterly terrify you. You know, that's how people responded to Jesus when he rose from the grave. And I think if you value people, if you say you have something unique to contribute, and then couple that with your humility, that really creates dialogue. And, you know, people have said we live in the most divided age. I think the thing that contributes to it is I associate your views with who you are as a person. So if you disagree with me, it's because you're a terrible person. So if you're pro Second Amendment, you're a terrible person. If you're pro choice, you're a terrible person. And while I do have my stances on those issues, that might not necessarily be true. They might genuinely just be looking for the way in which to help people the most. They might think a little differently than you, and shutting them down is not going to help.
Right. Like, I mean, if you completely refuse to listen to someone else, it's very rare to find someone who will listen back to someone who's just completely just like a windbag. Though I do think that one solution is if you are willing to hear someone out entirely, it's amazing to see how people will then be willing to listen to you in turn. Like, but it's hard to be that first big person to just be like, go ahead, spew all of it out. Yeah, just like, just all of it. Just let it all out. And then after they like exhaust themselves, be like, you know, that's really interesting. Let me ask you about this. You know, that's a difficult thing.
Yeah, I, somebody we both know, he's a pastor here in town, Damien Sheeter. He likes to say that what you do with people is you ask them questions about what they believe. And if you think it's wrong, your job is to not necessarily point it out right away. Be like, oh, you're wrong there. That's like that. And you move on. You ask them questions to get them to the point where they see that that belief maybe doesn't make sense. Or at the least, they flesh it out in a way that you understand it better. And then maybe you find out it makes sense. And he was using that for evangelism because he thinks you ask people to the point where they see their worldview as inconsistent, their way of living is inconsistent. But I think it works in a lot of different areas. And I really, really appreciate your point because it has to do with patience. I have friends who completely exhaust me because of their perspective on the world. And it's really, really hard to talk to them because those views, some of those views are so abhorrent and old to me. And I don't understand why they think that way. But I myself need to do a better job at practicing what I preach and listening to them.
Yeah. I mean, listening is difficult. It really is. It
really is.
Especially in a world where you have such easy access to the gratification of publishing your thoughts. So as we kind of wind down here, what is something, what are one, two, maybe even three things that someone can do to help establish better common ground in their life? That if they're feeling splintered, if they're dealing, you know, they feel splintered from other people, they feel splintered inside themselves. What are two or three takeaways? How could they solve that splinter inside themselves? How could they solve that splintering between them and other people?
Yeah, I think it starts with being willing to move towards people instead of recoiling from them and their views. Even as I just said that, there's somebody in my life who every time I meet with them, it is utterly and completely exhausting. And I need to move towards that person. And they disagree with some things, but I need to ask them questions. And I think really, really practically, in our age of expressive individualism, we like to judge ourselves based on our friends. And it's very, very easy to write someone off if you disagree with them. If they believe something, and especially with family, I'm experiencing this in my own life right now. And I need to be willing to move towards my family. I need to not write them off. I need to have them over and keep them in my life. Not just because they're family, but because it's probably good for me to have somebody from that perspective. And moreover, it's probably good for them to have somebody like me in their life. And I think this is the importance of what Wendell Berry would call the membership, being a part of something in terms of being covenanted with them. And because right now, it's really easy to just unfriend somebody. It's really easy to gather like-minded people around you.
To ghost them.
To ghost them, yes. And it's if you're a Christian, you, of course, have the church. So if you're a Christian, this is really easy for you. You don't get to move away from your church people because you are covenanted with them. You have an agreement to stick by them, to tell them the truth, and to bear their burdens. In other words, you're stuck with them. For those outside of the church, that's a lot harder. You know, you might have neighbors, but most of the time you're going to go to events, go to things with people in those, what Taylor would call those sources of the self. You're going to hang out with the people in your, who support the same soccer team or who work the same job as you. And it's going to be hard and it's going to take you actually being willing to say, I'm going to stick with this person because there's something about them that I like. There's something about them that we share in values and having those conversations. And it really just starts with the relationship, which is really hard for me because I'm an introvert. And every year that passes, I go up like one in the introvert scale. And it gets harder and harder for me. But I think...
What's the introvert scale? Is that like, you know, you have Kelvin for like heat, hot and cold? Like what's the introvert scale?
I think it's range. Some people say it's 1 to 10. I think it's probably more like 1 to 100. I think when I was born, I was about a 25. So now I'm at like 56. And by the time I die, I'll probably be at 100. I just won't see people anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like on a scale from like, you know, Matthew McConaughey to like Tim Burton. You know, it's like you'll just end with like that complete, just like, I'm just off by myself and yeah. I want to play
yeah.
with my claymation yeah. and just leave me alone.
Yeah. And I just thought of something else that makes this really hard right now is we're living in the age of coronavirus and people do not want to be together.
I mean, Ed, there is some understandable reasons for that. Yeah.
There's some understandable reasons for that. But
some people use that as an excuse too.
Yeah. This engaging purely over the internet will just continue to depersonalize. So even if you're utterly terrified of COVID-19, if you think it's the worst thing since the Black Plague, if there are like three people you see, keep seeing those people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You definitely have to keep some kind of human contact. Like that's like scientifically like
yeah.
a good, like whatever damage COVID yeah. could do to your body, like yeah. not seeing human beings will not work well for you.
Yeah. We did Uber Eats this last week. It was the first time we really did it. It was so expensive. Not worth it at all. But they have a new option where the person – you don't even see the person. They just They just leave it outside your door.
They're like gnomes. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's just like
– it's like Christmas.
Magic.
Yeah. Oh, it's in my stocking.
Yeah. That's the real reason we do it. Even though it's like really expensive, we do it just because it feels like Christmas. That's why I order things from Amazon. Yeah. I would never shop like this in a brick and mortar store, but just on Amazon, I'm like, it'll come in the mail and I'll have a package.
They don't use brick really anymore in Florida. It's not hurricane safe, I think.
Okay. You know what? That's a fair point. So I don't, I obviously don't shop in brick like that. So if somebody wants to learn more about this, where's a good place for them to start?
Well, if you want to start with Taylor, I would start with How Not to Be Secular by James K. Smith. And I would read that. And then if you take a deep breath and you say, okay, I want to keep reading Taylor, then I would keep the Jamie Smith book and I would read Taylor because Jamie Smith has a glossary in there that helps you understand terms. And speaking of which, like Taylor's really readable for a philosopher because he's really telling a story. So it really is narrative.
Joe just likes making slight burns because I gave him a copy of Gadamer and he was trying to be nice about it. But also he just like looked at me and was like, this man is incomprehensible.
Yes, utterly. Well, he's a German existentialist, which just means he's speaking gibberish to me.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
And just half the words That's are fair. Like untranslated. And it's like, come on, man. At least with Taylor does throw in some French in there because he teaches in Quebec. And so sometimes it's not translated, which is just great. Then you have to look it up. And for Peterson's harder. I would say I would start with 12 Rules for Life. Or if you're...
It's approachable, yeah.
If you really want to start...
It's funny, the intro to that book is actually way heavier than the book itself.
Yeah.
So, like, if you read the introduction first, which a lot of people will skip that, but if you read the introduction first, I was like, this is pretty heavy. And then I, like, went to the actual book, and I was like, oh, this is easy. So don't judge the book by the introduction.
Yeah, don't judge the book by the introduction, for sure. And if you want to see different sides of Peterson, if you want a funny one, look up his interview with Kathy Newman. That one's a treat. And there's a documentary on Amazon Prime called The Rise of Jordan Peterson. That's very, very good as well. So those are a couple plays. But I would start with 12 Rules for Life if I started anywhere.
I think one thing – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And just real quick, I beg you, if you are a Christian man and you read 12 Rules for Life and you throw it away because he talks about evolutionary psychology, I will find you. Finish the book. That's what we talked about, where somebody disagrees with you and it's just like, I'm going to discard all their views. It's like, no, what if they have something helpful to say?
Oh, and I'm gonna just destroy this quote. But there's a quote by Calvin that's like, if all truth comes from God, if you find truth wherever you find it, you know that it's a good gift from God. Yeah. And so I think that's something that's been kind of like a leading mantra for me, that you can find truth in all sorts of different places. It may be out of context. It may not fit. Yeah. But there are definitely things that you say, like someone says, you're like, well, that's just true. Like, you can't like deny that. And that can be from anybody.
So there's this Catholic historian. His name's Gary Wills. And he talks about his Catholic upbringing, and specifically in high school. And he's like, I don't really remember anything except some obscure Latin phrases. And for me, one I remember is Logos Spermaticos, which is the idea, like you were just saying, that God's truth is scattered. It's seated in all sorts of different areas, not just in Scripture, which we would call special revelation. It's in general revelation, too. You're going to find truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I would just add, like, for me, one of the most helpful things for watching Jordan Peterson, because a lot of people will point to his more controversial stuff. And I don't remember who, maybe it was Dr. Oz. I don't really know daytime television, but he was asked to counsel because he is at his heart Dr. a clinical Oz interview psychologist. Is
amazing.
Is that the one where he deals with the couple that's trying not to divorce, but they're
I'm
going
pretty
to?
Sure.
That, like, if you look up Jordan Peterson saving divorced couple, you can see what I think he's really all about. And I disagree with him. I've seen some of the stuff, like, you know, I have a background in philosophy. And so there's stuff on, like, the philosophical side that I disagree with, but that's his background is in psychology, especially
because you're a postmodernist.
That's fair. That's fair. But clinical, his background is clinical psychology. So when you see him actually practicing clinical psychology, you're like, ah, this is what he does. And he does it so well. And it really makes sense of a lot of his messaging. So if you have doubts about him, that's a good place to start as well.
Agreed.
Oh, Joe, I just want to say thank you so much, man. This has been so much fun and totally
pleasure.
Worth it.
I mean, if you really want to build your listenership, it starts with having someone as widely known as I am. So
yeah,
it's a good
you know,
idea.
I mean, I like to think, you know, if I can get someone half famous on here, then, you know, maybe I can get up to quarter famous. That's my goal.
I'm known by several schools in the area by that as that person that you just don't hire no matter what. So they know my name. They know my name.
That is not standing with your shoulders back.
No, I've learned to be proud of it. I've learned to be proud.
I just accept it. All right. Appreciate you, man. And thanks.
You too, dude.